And we are back here on Newsline chatting with Godfrey Pearlson. He is a professor, a Yale neuroscience professor, a psychiatric researcher, and a physician. And he has written a book, The Science of Weed. Professor, welcome to Newsline. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Bridget. Great to be on the show.
Wow, this is a thick book. There's a lot in here. We are going to try to condense it a little bit, but I think maybe the place to start, Professor, is for you to briefly explain to us exactly how does weed affect your brain? In other words, how does it make us feel differently?
Well, our brain is full of weed receptors. We have what's called an endocannabinoid system distributed through our body. That exists not to get us high, but to help the developing brain to control pain and to orchestrate neurotransmitters in the brain that control our behavior. And what THC and CBD, the main chemicals in the cannabis plant, do is tweak those endocannabinoid system neuroreceptors to change our feelings and perceptions.
Okay. And are younger people, are younger brains affected differently than older brains?
Well, that's a great question. So let me try and answer that for you.
Okay.
Younger brains are still developing. So if teenagers use high concentrations of cannabis, that is cannabis with a lot of THC, the main intoxicant in it, and start early and use often, they may be having effects on their developing brains, since the endocannabinoid system controls brain growth. So two risks are that it may affect our cognition. It may tweak our IQ and shave a few points off it. And it also greatly increases the risk for developing psychotic illnesses like schizophrenia, maybe three or four times. And that's something that happens at people only in that age group, not to adults in their 20s and over. Then there are risks for people aged over 65. They're more likely to become delirious. They're more likely to fall. And they may have cardiac problems, although that last thing is not well established.
Okay. All right. And I do want to delve into some of the potentially harmful effects of long-term use and such. But again, just to begin with the basics, since legalization, can you tell us, like, how much use has increased, has skyrocketed, really? I mean, it just seems, Professor, it is just everywhere. You can't go anywhere without seeing a sign for some THC or CBD product or a dispensary.
Yeah, or smelling it on the street.
Oh, my gosh, well, yeah.
Yeah, I guess what I'd point out is, although it's legal in many states, either for medicinal or recreational purposes, it's still federally illegal. So we've not taken the big step that Canada did and legislate that cannabis use can be legal nationally. So there's a patchwork of regulations in different states that are really different. It's not a coherent policy. But yes, you're absolutely right. Since Connecticut and surrounding states have legalized cannabis for recreational and medicinal purposes, you do see dispensaries everywhere, and use has actually gone up in epidemiologic studies. So 50% of the people in the U.S. say they've used at one time or another, and 15% of adults say we used in the last week. So it is everywhere.
Yeah, and I would think, too, for people who were smoking it or ingesting it through gummies or whatever before it was legal, that they would be partaking even more now because it is legal. It's, you know, we're being told it's okay.
Yes. Again, you're right. So that if people feel there are not penalties, they're not going to be prosecuted or go to jail for being caught with some weed on them. And harm perception has changed, so people are less likely to think of it as a dangerous substance. All of those have increased use. So people in my age that went through the 60s that may not have used for years because of worries about illegality are one of the fastest increasing groups in terms of cannabis use now.
Right. Yeah. I'm close to where you are age-wise, it sounds like. I am old enough to remember seeing those crazy Reefer Madness videos of, you know, with trying to scare you straight and, you know, never go near marijuana. And when I was growing up, I mean, people certainly smoked it, but it was a really risky thing to do. Not so much because of health effects, because of being afraid of that, but just being afraid of getting caught.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. And,
So the penalties are a lot less and the substance is more available. And that's changed the landscape. And what's in cannabis has also changed. It's what you and I might have been familiar with a few decades back is not the cannabis that's on the market now.
Yeah, let me ask you about that because, again, what I hear is that if you buy weed in a dispensary and you smoke a joint, it is a lot more potent than something you would have smoked a roll your own way back when, you know, several decades ago or whatever. Is that true? And if so, why?
So that's a tribute to human ingenuity and selective plant breeding.
Ah.
So just as we like chickens with meatier thighs or steaks with less fat and better flavor, people have bred the cannabis plant to have more intoxicants in it. So a couple of decades ago might have had 5% THC in it, and that's tetrahydrocannabinol, the chemical that actually gets us high. And now it's 20% plus. And it's not just flower that we would smoke in a joint. There are now tinctures and concentrates and dabs and shatter that are distillates of the cannabis plant that might have up to 90% of THC in them. So it's almost pure chemical.
Hmm. Yeah. I would think you really have to kind of know what you're doing, too. Even some of the gummies, I've heard that even the smaller dosages can do a number on you.
Yes, if you're not used to it and you haven't maybe used before and you're older, the pharmacokinetics are different and people can become unexpectedly delirious or have panic attacks or have their heart speed up in a way that they didn't expect because they're not used to the new concentrations of THC.
Mm-hmm. Since legalization, and as you point out, it's scattered, you know, it's not a federally legalized, but recreationally. But has that led to more, or would you say less study on the effects?
Many effects are understudied. So the Food and Drug Administration still has cannabis classified as a Schedule I substance. What they mean by that is that, by their definition, it has a high chance of abuse or addiction and absolutely no approved medical use. So although states have legalized exactly as you say in many cases, the government hasn't reclassified or descheduled or rescheduled cannabis. So it's still really difficult to get permission to do the research that's needed. So, for example, in my lab, we have to store the cannabis that we give to subjects inside of a locked room, inside of another locked room, inside of a safe that's buried 2 feet into concrete in the floor on a steel rod with a video camera and an electronic alarm.
Well, there you go. That's a... Yeah, that's a lot of layers of security there. And we are back on Newsline on WICC with the author of a new book, Answering All Your Questions About Marijuana. The Science of Weed is the name of the book. And the author is Yale neuroscience professor Godfrey Pearlson. Thanks so much for sticking with us through the break. And as I mentioned before we took that break, a recent New York Times story, I think I'm pretty sure it was on the first page, said that there was a study done in 11 sites across Europe and that it found that people who regularly consumed marijuana with at least 10% THC, we were talking about that, were nearly five times as likely to develop a psychotic disorder as those who never used it. Did you see that, Professor? And I imagine you did. And what did you think of that?
Yeah, well, my other hat is, in terms of research, is psychosis research. So Robin Murray, who's the scientist who, one of the scientists in the UK who pioneered that study, actually wrote a book with another Yale psychiatrist called Deepak D'Souza called Marijuana and Madness. So this issue of schizophrenia or psychosis and cannabis has been very active for at least 15 years. And the big question is, are people who smoke cannabis and develop a psychotic illness individuals who would have developed it anyway? So is this just giving them a final nudge in that direction? Or are they people who are not at high risk, who would never have developed the illness if they never used cannabis? And what that study that you alluded to helps us understand is that these are people who probably were not at high risk, and that's supported by epidemiologic research from Scandinavia that shows that the risk of psychosis in relationship to cannabis seems to be increasing. So it's actually pushing people in that direction, probably due to increased THC in cannabis used by young people who are those who are vulnerable, people in their early to mid-teens in particular. And there are probably two mechanisms. One is that cannabis is rewiring their brains. So since the endocannabinoid system helps our brains develop normally, it's somehow diverting those pathways as they develop. And also THC releases dopamine in the brain. You can think of it as a sort of amphetamine-like substance in that way, although the mechanism's completely different. And dopamine can trigger psychosis in individuals who may be at risk. So we think it's a real effect. It's particularly teenagers, and we think we know something about the mechanism.
That's really interesting. I mentioned, the portion of this that I read said that these were people who, quote unquote, regularly consumed marijuana. And I guess my question, Professor, is, you know, how much is too much? You know, when you think of young people and you think of the joke about, kids who wake and bake, just from a common sense standpoint, that would seem like too much.
Yeah, absolutely. It all comes down to age and dose and frequency. So kids who start earlier, who use greater quantities of cannabis at higher concentrations more often, are those who are vulnerable. So what I tell my kids is, if you're going to use weed, wait until you're 21. And that's not for legal reasons so much as it is for biological illness risk reasons.
Wow. Okay. That sounds like solid advice. 21. Wow. Well, we've been talking about the potential detriments. What about the potential benefits? Is that something that you talk about in your book?
Yes, a lot. So CBD, cannabidiol, which is one of the other cannabinoids in the cannabis plant, is now approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treating intractable childhood epilepsy. The plant probably contains anti-inflammatory drugs that act through a different kind of CB receptor, CB2 receptors. THC seems to be very useful for chronic pain, and some people think it may be a substitute for opioid drugs in chronic pain control, although that's very controversial, and the evidence really isn't in it completely on that. And some people use it as a sleep aid, and it's useful in the short term, but probably not in the long term.
Okay. Have you noticed an increase in medicinal use of marijuana with the legalization of marijuana recreationally?
Yes. If you talk to local dispensary owners in Connecticut, they say that one thing they notice is there's been a sharp increase in people aged over 65 who are using it for such things as arthritis pain control or chronic low back pain and to for insomnia. So those are big consumers. The number of people using overall has gone up, but the number of people using for medicinal purposes has also gone up. I'm on the board of physicians that advises Connecticut's Department of Public Health on what are sensible medical uses for medicinal cannabis. So we get lots of requests, and things related to chronic pain syndromes are among the biggest ones.
And before we go, and again, as I say, this book is really comprehensive, but I guess one last question for you is, do you think that we will come to having it legalized recreationally nationwide across the board?
People have spoken up in a very tentative way about that. North of the border, we have the example of Canada, where things seem to have worked out not exactly as well as people expected, but not the disaster that people predicted. So it could work. It just takes someone having the guts to say, yes, we think this is a good idea, and that the good consequences will outweigh the bad ones if we can have laws with teeth to prevent sale or distribution to individuals under 21.
Right.
And we can, minimize harms and maximize benefits from the drug.
The Science of Weed is the name of the book, and the author is Yale neuroscience professor Godfrey Perlson. We thank you so much, Professor. It's a fascinating read. The Science of Weed, the name of the book. Thanks again.
Bridget, thank you so much.
All right. And back here, we are taking your calls on WICC for this next segment. The number is 203-333-9422. That's because we are talking about pizza. And if you love pizza as much as I do, you just might have some questions about it. And we are lucky enough to have the co-host of Charred, a New Haven pizza show. You hear it weekends here, 5:30 to 6 o'clock on Saturdays. And one of the co-hosts is here, Kevin Begley. You also know him from Star. You know the voice. And you co-host with Frank Zabski, right? The owner of New Haven Pizza School?
Yeah, that's right. So Frank and I, we started this show on National Pizza Day this past February. So we do the podcast together. It's on YouTube. It's on podcast platforms. And yeah, he owns the New Haven Pizza School. I'm a radio guy who just loves pizza. And we started this show, and it's been a blast.
That is a sweet gig, if you ask
yeah,
me.
Exactly.
I love that. I love that. And I asked you during the break, I was telling you that when I was prepping for this segment, I Googled New Haven Pizza School. I thought maybe it was like a funny, clever name for a pizza parlor.
Like,
but
a restaurant.
No, it's a school. It's an actual school.
He does full-on classes that people sign up for, and it's a couple hours, and you learn how to make the dough and the sauce, specifically New Haven style, like you get on Worcester Street at Pepe's and Sally's and all that. And he has, I mean, he's grown it into this huge thing. It's actually how I met him like 3 or 4 years ago. He was just getting it off the ground, and my wife got it for me for Father's Day. And at that time, he was coming to your house, and he would teach you how to make the pizza like in your kitchen.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. You know, I feel like when you're making pizzas, and we do sometimes,
yeah,
but I wind up doing the quick and dirty method and buying the pre-made crust or the naan or whatever, you know. So that component of it, but it is so much better when you make the dough. I would think that that's the trickiest part. That's where you can really learn something if you go to the New Haven Pizza School.
Yeah, definitely. And the dough, you're right, because it's baking, so you got to be a little precise, but it's easier than people think. I think people think like, I'm going to make my whole thing from scratch, but the dough is very simple. And we just our last episode we just did was a how-to on how to make the New Haven style dough.
Okay.
So it's about 10, 20 minutes, the video, and then you learn how to do it. It's like three ingredients. It's the dry yeast, it's the salt, water, and then you mix it all together and some flour. And in the video, he gives you all the measurements. It's great.
And how long do you have to wait for it to rise, if at all?
Yeah, so you do it and you let it sit overnight in the refrigerator. Usually, he says the sweet spot. Frank says 3 days is the sweet spot. So if you're going to make pizza on Saturday.
You got a plan.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right.
So if you're going to make pizza to get it to taste the best. So if you're going to make pizza on Saturday night, Wednesday, you make the dough, you let it sit in the refrigerator, and then take it out like 3 to 4 hours before you're going to make it on Saturday and let it rise in room temperature. Mm-hmm. Then you're ready to go.
We always debate about this, no matter what kind of crust we have, if it's homemade or if it's pre-store-bought.
Yeah.
Do you bake it first? I like to bake it first and then put the stuff on and then put it in the hot oven.
So a lot of people do it that way. And
is that okay?
Fine. Yeah, that's totally fine. That's the best part about pizza. You have your different style.
Okay.
If you're cooking in the home oven, that's a good way to do it.
Right.
So I have this pizza steel that's literally a slab of steel, and you preheat it in the oven, and you can cook the pizza right on that instead of the grates or a pan. And it stores the heat in that steel. So you preheat it for like an hour. And it really helps cook the dough like a pizza place.
Ah.
And then in the summertime, in the nice weather, I have a little uni pizza oven that I bring out back that is like the fire style with the propane.
Oh, and that's awesome.
So when I do that, I don't pre-bake the dough because I just like turning it like a pizzeria, you know?
Yeah, because in-home oven, I don't like to put stuff right on the rack.
Right, because it sticks and it's a mess.
And then I wind up in my head, you know, scrubbing the oven. let's talk New Haven Pizza. And it's funny, I was reading some of your notes. ABEETZ. This is how you spell a beets. How do you say it? And why are you supposed to say it that way?
So if you see, Frank always jokes, it's the way you know if somebody doesn't know New Haven Pizza, if they call it a pizza, because that's how it's spelled in all the signs.
Yeah, I've done that.
Right.
I've done that.
So have I, like when I first met him. the way that they say it is a beets. And it's basically just how the Italians who came over here when they were making pizza way back in New Haven, you know, back when it first started, that's just how a casual way they would say it, like, oh, a beets. A beets. And that's just how it was said. And so they still spell it a pizza, but it's pronounced a beets.
A beets. I'm going to keep my notes from this so I know what the heck I'm talking about next time I go to New Haven. And I did go to New Haven recently. My son's up in college in Boston. He wanted me to take him to the station.
Oh, awesome.
And he said, well, why don't we time it?
Yeah.
And we'll go to one of the pizza places. Now, I guess they're all in a general vicinity. What did you say? Worcester
Street.
Okay, so that's sort of the murderer's row area of good beets. Yeah.
Yep. So Worcester Street, the big two are Sally's and Frank Pepe's. So they're sort of like, you know, think about cheesesteaks in Philadelphia. They're like the rival, you know, Pepe's and Sally's are the two big ones. The originals. Then there's Modern, which is they talk about the big three.
Yeah.
Modern, Pepe's, and Sally's. Yeah. And then you have Bar New Haven, which has really good pizza. You have Zanelli's. So you have so many in that little area.
Yeah.
And then as you expand, we always say there's the secret sort of places in the suburbs too. Like West Haven has Zupardi's. You have a bunch on the outskirts. Ernie's is right down the street from Worcester Street in New Haven. So there's an endless, like if you wanted to go to New Haven and spend a whole entire day or weekend, you could hit them all up. Yeah.
A pizza crawl.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we did a little bit of that just because we couldn't get in at Sally's.
Yeah, it's tough.
And then I forget, we might have tried Pepe's and then we wound up in Modern, which was fantastic. So is there one that has, you know, that rates higher than any of the others, or are they all?
It's one of those preference things. I think when you ask somebody what's your favorite New Haven style pizza in New Haven, they'll mention one of those three: Pepe's, Sally's, or Modern. But I think Pepe's and Sally's, they're the two ones that people travel for and they like to wait in line. It's like a whole experience, you know.
Yeah.
Personally, I love Modern. I think their pizza is unbelievable.
It was delicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really good.
And it's more of a sit-down restaurant. The other two are very small. You know, Pepe's and Sally's, they're tiny. That's why there's always lines.
Yeah.
They do have booths and places you can sit, but I feel like Modern's more of a spread out type restaurant. They have a dining room in the back.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't go wrong. Like if you're going to go get New Haven pizza, like it's hard to find a bad one.
Is there a difference in how they make it? You know, a difference among Sally's and Modern and Pepe's, or is it all the same type of pizza?
I think they all try to say like, well, we make it they don't give away their secrets, you know, but you know, when Frank teaches it in his class, he's like, they all sort of follow this recipe to make it New Haven style. So one of the big things is the flour. So New Haven style uses bread flour as opposed to all purpose flour, or there's the 00 flour that a lot of Neapolitan style pizza uses. So over in Italy, you have those kind of fluffy crusts like the margherita style with the little pieces of mozzarella on it. Very light and fluffy. But New Haven style uses bread flour, which gives it that thin crust with the kind of crunchiness. Yeah.
Bread flour. The thin crust.
Yep.
Okay. Do they do anything different in terms of like cheese distribution versus sauce?
Well, the sauce is very simple. It's the canned tomatoes and the peeled canned tomatoes, and they just crush them themselves and add a little bit of oregano, a little bit of salt. and that's it. So like the, Frank always says, like the New Haven style sauce is the simplest sauce. Like don't, I mean, you, if you wanted to add your own flavoring, you could.
Yeah.
But to get it New Haven style, it's salt, it's a little bit of oregano pinch, and then those peeled canned tomatoes just crushed up, and mixed around.
Is there a terminology too? I feel like we were warned that a certain kind of pizza is going to be just sauce unless you.
Yeah,
like you have to say with cheese when you order. Oh my gosh, I sound like such a hopeless novice. But we just moved back to Connecticut in December, so I'm getting an education.
No, these are all perfect questions. I always say a mozzarella. Frank will say it's mozzarella. But the New Haven style plain is just sauce with pecorino cheese on it.
Yeah,
and that's New Haven style plain. So that's where a lot of people get tripped up. It's not actually mozzarella cheese. It's just red sauce with the pecorino cheese,
okay,
which is delicious. Like, it's really good. But some people say, like, oh, I'll have a plain, thinking it's the right. cheese they're used to.
That's what I think happened.
Yeah,
we said plain, and they must have pegged us for novices. You know what that is, right?
Mozzarella. And one of the interesting little hacks, if you're making it at home and you want to really make it New Haven style, go to the deli and get mozzarella sliced super thin as they can slice it. And the little pieces. And when you make it, you put it on the sauce, and the sauce kind of bleeds through the cheese a little bit. And that's how it's New Haven style.
Oh, my gosh. I am so hungry. Lunchtime, and we are here on Newsline this afternoon to make you hungry. That is because we are speaking with Kevin Begley, the co-host of Charred, a New Haven pizza show, and it airs on Saturdays 5:30 to 6. You guys timed that, right? So 5:30 on a
right
Saturday, it's like 6 o'clock. You know what? Let's order a pizza now. And it sounds like a plan. We were talking about all things New Haven pizza. And when I worked in the city, we every so often would get a survey on, you know, who has the best
pizza. Yeah.
And, you know, let the debates begin, right?
True.
Yeah. We had a guy who was from Fairfield. Was like, are you kidding me? New Haven? Of course it's the best pizza. And then the Jersey guys would weigh in and, of course, the New Yorkers. But I guess, what's the biggest difference? Because some New York pizza has thinner crust. What is the essential difference between New York and New Haven?
Yeah, so New York-style pizza tends to be a bigger slice. It's a little thicker. You're right. Certain pizzerias will make it thinner. The New Haven style, though, it's got that crackery crunch to it and the char. So we called the show Charred because they have that char where they wood fire it, coal fire ovens, and they get that little kind of blood. And a lot of people think it's burnt if they've never had New Haven style. But we always say it's not burnt. It's charred. and you get that sort of like leoparding pattern of that char
like
on
the
crust.
Do you get the bubbles?
Yeah, a little
kind
bit.
Of thing? Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bubbles aren't a bad thing. A lot of people say like there's bubbles. That's good. And you get that char on the edge. And, you know, the New York style, it tends to be a little, you know, not as stiff. Like New Haven style can be stiff on the edges. It's got that crunch to it and a little more doughy on the New York style. But I love New York pizza, too. I mean, if I go to New York City, I'm getting a slice. Like, it's still delicious. It's just a different style. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was telling you during the commercial, I was recently in Westport at ME Squared, is it?
Yeah.
And I had no idea going in, but it was Detroit style. I've never been to Detroit.
Yeah.
Didn't know that was a style of pizza, but it was really, really good. Yeah. It was kind of like, how would you're the expert.
Yeah.
How would you describe
it? Well, it's almost, Detroit style is becoming more and more popular now. And it's almost like if you've ever had a Sicilian slice, that's like they call them grandma slices some places. It looks like that. It's squared like that. And it has that little, it's sort of crunchy on the outside, and it's a little fluffy on the inside. And the big difference with Detroit style is they put the cheese and then they put a strip of sauce on top of it.
Okay.
So a lot of times if it's a cheese slice, the sauce is on top. ME Squared, I have my sister-in-law lives in Brooklyn, and I think that's where it started in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
And now they have them in Connecticut, and they're they're unbelievable. It just tastes so good when you bite into those Detroit-style pizzas.
Yeah, it's that combination of like very, very crusty, but a little bit more dough.
Yeah.
But they had a great variety of toppings with the, you know, kind of classic New Haven pizzas that we were talking about, the big three.
Yeah.
Sally's, Modern, and Pepe's. Are there fewer choices when it comes to topping? Like, do you need to be a purist and say, no, you know what? I'm going to experience New Haven pizza and just have the cheese served.
Yeah. Well, my big thing, I always say, I've been like this all my life. If I'm going to a new place, I always get cheese to start as a base. Because if they don't screw up, if they can make a cheese pizza and not screw it up, then I know the rest of their pizza is good.
Right.
If you were going for the first time to these famous places, I would suggest to get a cheese to start just so you can experience the cheese pizza. But their menus are, they have a lot of other toppings that you can get. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the white clam pie is a big staple in New Haven. A lot of people love that if you like
white
seafood.
Clam pie. Okay.
That's one of the huge signature pizzas at Pepe's, is the white clam. So, yeah, people love that one.
I tend to like more basic toppings.
I'm with you. I'm the same way.
I don't like the chicken pineapple thing.
Pineapple,
that
stay
to
away.
Me is not pizza.
Yeah, no.
But I bet you a lot of people would argue, right. Yes, it is pizza. It is.
No pineapple on pizza. Yeah, it's the best part of pizza. You know, you can make your own. You can do your own toppings. You can have it however you like. But I'm with you. I like less toppings.
Yeah, we've been kind of experimenting a little bit. And we did a pie with, and I feel like I had this at a Mario Batali restaurant. They used to have the Terry Lodge in Westport. It's not there anymore.
Oh, yeah, I remember that place.
Yeah, but it was a pizza with... it was like a coating of ricotta or ragout, and then some pistachios.
Yum.
And then some hot honey.
Yeah. So the hot honey, when I make pizza at home, I use hot honey a lot. I've made a pepperoni pizza before with hot honey. And if you like heat, you do hot honey and some of the red pepper flakes. And it's really good.
Absolutely delicious. And you know what I wonder, too? I think we have a caller on the line. Look at that. We do. Jeff from Westport. He must have heard us talking about ME Square. Jeff, go ahead. You're on Newsline.
Hey, how you doing? Pizza, pizza. The square pizza is just like Rocky Rococo's pizza out of the Midwest. And Pepe's pizza, I wouldn't spend $32 on a cheese pizza if you paid me. The only way I get Pepe's pizza is if I get it for free with my points at Mohegan Sun Casino. They are so overpriced. $32 for a cheese pizza, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you for the call. Well, you know, I was telling you when I ran into you here at the Connoisseur Studios, I paid close to $50. I'm not going to say the name, but
ridiculous.
came in a huge box, and I thought it was going to be bigger than it was. We were so hungry that night. You know, my question for you, Kevin, is this: now we're seeing all of these, the famous New Haven pizzerias. We're seeing them everywhere, right? So I wonder, does that like dilute the quality at all? For instance, like, I think there's a Sally's now in like the Sono Mall. So I wonder, is that, if I go there and I get it, is it going to be the same as if I had gone to New Haven to the Sally's?
So it's interesting. A lot of these, a lot of these places, they're expanding. And so Sally's, I know, is expanding almost like franchising to other parts of the country, too.
Yeah.
Pepe's aren't really franchises. They're actually just opening new locations with the same ownership.
Okay.
But it is.
Oh, and just in Connecticut, Pepe? No, there is one
in Massachusetts, too.
And New York, too. Yep. Actually, when I was in Westchester, there was a Pepe's.
Yep, there's one down there, too.
There's probably one in the city.
Yep.
Yeah.
And but Pepe, so my opinion is, if you go to New Haven, to Worcester Street, to the original places, you get the experience, and it goes to what Jeff was saying on the phone about the pricing.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to Worcester Street, New Haven, you're paying for the experience. It's like when you go to a high-end restaurant, you know, you're paying for everything that comes with it. And in my opinion, you're paying for the whole thing. You know, you're not just getting pizza down the street, delivery to your house. Like, you're going to this New Haven style pizza. You came all this way. You waited in line. Like, you're going to pay the $35. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
And as far as the locations, like you were saying, it's hard for them to replicate exactly New Worcester Street location. So what a lot of them are doing are putting some of their, you know, staff that works there and training these other people in the other locations to teach them how to make it New Haven style. I told Frank, I'm like, this is what you should do. You should just like train all these different locations that they open on how to make it the right way.
Boy, that would be a big business there at the New Haven pizza school. Yeah. What are you talking about this weekend? Anything in particular? You want to give a plug for the show coming up?
So I believe the one airing this weekend is the last episode we released, which is how to make the New Haven style dough. So making New Haven style dough, like I said, it's simple, but we go through all the steps, and it's about a 20 to 22 minute thing. And yeah, we talk about that. And then we'll record the next episode probably next week. that will come out next Friday.
Oh, that's great. And you don't just do how-tos.
Right.
What else do you do on the show?
Yeah, so we talk about pizza news, you know, if there's new pizza places opening.
Pizza headlines.
Yeah, all kinds of pizza. You'd be surprised. There's a lot of pizza headlines. Or pizza topics. You know, we'll go to Facebook and we'll ask people, you know, what they want to hear about, what they want to talk about. We'll answer people's questions about making their own pizzas. And then we also will go to locations, too. So we've done a bunch of episodes at famous pizzerias here in Connecticut, and we'll interview the owner. We'll do an episode on location.
Yeah. Wonderful gig.
Yeah, it's fun.
So great to have you here, Kevin Begley, and check out Charred, a New Haven pizza show, if you haven't already, 5:30 to 6 o'clock Saturday evenings. And I don't think I have time during the commercial break to run out and get something to
eat. I know,
eat.
I feel
it's
bad.
So
I should have brought some pizza.
No, I didn't mean it that way. It was just so much fun talking with you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Thank you so much.